From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The Michigan Supreme Court hears arguments about whether 44,000 people who were wrongfully accused of unemployment benefits fraud can sue.
In 2013, someone thought that it was a good idea to lay off about 400 fraud claims examiners and put in their place an automated system called MIDAS.
We'll hear from a Michigan state representative on what the state should do to make sure veterans get the benefits to which they're entitled.
As a state government, we have to say, look, we need to increase the level of service we provide at the county level to our veterans and their families.
And in Michigan history, we hear why a house on Detroit's east side is getting historic recognition and about the African-American doctor who moved into the white neighborhood in the 1920s.
Because of the violence over the summer over on the west side, when African-Americans had moved into white neighborhoods, he understood this is a huge risk.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll continue discussing why some veterans in Michigan aren't getting the benefits they're entitled to.
The whole clutch of our system in Michigan is making sure that when that veteran does need help, that they know where to go.
That's Republican State Representative Jason Wentworth. Earlier this year, he got a bill signed into law that provides funding for counties to help more veterans. We'll hear more from him a little later in the show. But first, the Michigan Supreme Court is hearing arguments today on whether 44,000 people wrongfully accused of unemployment insurance fraud can sue the state. To remind us all what happened, I've pulled an excerpt from a story by my colleague Rebecca Kruth. She did this in the summer of 2015. She explained at the time the state's automated unemployment insurance system was causing havoc for people, and she talked with the director of the Michigan Unemployment Insurance Project, Steve Gray, who called that system robo-fraud.
The system is called MIDAS. It scans the database and looks for discrepancies, cases where information an employee gave to get benefits doesn't match what their employer said.
And then very quickly and without any human intervention makes a fraud determination against people.
In 2014, the State Unemployment Insurance Agency established over 26,000 cases of unemployment fraud. That's more than five times the yearly average. A fraud charge comes with a penalty four times the amount a claimant was allegedly overpaid, plus interest. There's a 30-day window to appeal, and then after that, the charge is final, and the UIA can garnish wages and tax returns.
Which means that the agency doesn't have to go to court like everybody else does in order to get a garnishment order. And so you combine the four times penalty and the robo-fraud and the administrative garnishment, and you have what happened to David Vella.
David Vella collected unemployment for nearly a year after he was laid off from his job as an electrician. He didn't even know there was a fraud charge against him until money started disappearing from his paycheck.
It was a quarter of my pay every week. So I had to work. Thank God I was able to, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, just to be able to pay the bills.
The state had sent his determination to the wrong address 2 years before that, so he didn't get a chance to appeal within the 30-day window. Vella had to file a late protest, and the agency refused to stop garnishing his wages.
That's Michigan Radio's Rebecca Kruth from a story she filed on July 24th of 2015. Joining me now is the lead attorney in a class action lawsuit against the state, Jennifer Lord. So tell us how this case ended up before the Supreme Court.
Well, it's been a long and tortured history. We filed this case back in 2015, and the reason that we're before the Supreme Court later on today is that because the Attorney General's office has been fighting us tooth and nail every step of the way. And this is despite the fact that the agency now admits that it was wrong, and it falsely accused these 40,000 people of fraud, that it falsely took almost $100 million out of Michiganders' pockets. It convicted wrongfully almost 200 people. And as late as yesterday, the Attorney General himself issued a statement acknowledging this and apologizing for it. And yet today he's sending an entire team of attorneys to continue to defend the indefensible and try and get this case thrown out of court.
Well, let's talk about that statement just for a second, because it basically explained that he had a responsibility to, and we're talking about Bill Schuette, Attorney General Bill Schuette, explaining he had a responsibility to defend all of Michigan's laws, whether he personally agreed or not, and regardless of whether the law is a good one. So that sounds like an official doing his job.
Well, it sure sounds like some nice words, but the law that is at issue here is the Michigan Constitution. And the Michigan Constitution clearly says that someone, especially the state, cannot seize property without due process. And that's what this lawsuit is all about. The state of Michigan seized these millions of dollars without due process. And so to the extent that he says he's trying to uphold the law, it's certainly not the Michigan Constitution.
Now, I take it that this is something the unemployment agency has had the power to do for some time. It's just now we're all a lot more aware of it. How did it get that power to begin with?
Well, it got the power because in 2013, someone thought that it was a good idea to lay off about 400 fraud claims examiners and put in their place an automated system called MIDAS, which is completely ironic because it's the opposite of the touch of gold. And what this computer did is all by itself, with zero human intervention, decided that people were guilty of fraud, assessed a quadruple penalty, and then moved into seizing their tax refunds and garnishing their wages at a rate of 25%. Most of the people had no notice of this at all. They didn't even know that they had been accused of fraud until their tax refunds were seized. So it began with the misguided decision to use a computer to do something a computer was never designed to do. I mean, it can't examine evidence. It can't determine credibility. Those are things that people need to do. And that's really one of the untold stories in this case, is that as we move towards additional artificial intelligence and automation, we always have to have human beings overseeing it so that debacles like this never, ever happen again.
By the time the state recognized the mistakes that was being made by this automated system and started reimbursing people wrongfully accused of fraud, what kind of damage, financial damage, had been done to their lives?
Well, let me just push back on that premise. The state didn't stop this practice until a series of lawsuits, including this lawsuit, were brought. So this was nothing that they did voluntarily. I can tell you that I've spent a lot of time going through some super boring documents, including audited financial statements, and looking at them line by line by line to try and figure out exactly how much money was taken. I can tell you that it's about $100 million that you can follow through these financial reports on a specific line item. I can also tell you that the state in August of 2017 made public statements that it had refunded $21 million to people. Again, being kind of a nerd, I went and looked at the latest audited financial statement. And the line item on that statement says that $5.9 million were refunded. And every single person that's called our office who has received a refund has only received a partial refund. And there's no rhyme or reason to the amount. Let's say someone had $10,000 seized from them, they'll get a refund for $6,500. And there's no itemization, there's no explanation for why the state is still holding money that doesn't belong to it.
So what has this done to their lives?
Oh, the range of harms is just breathtaking. About 1,100 people have had to file bankruptcy. People have become homeless. I mean, remember the population of people that this impacted, all right? These were people who had just lost their jobs. They were the least able to go out and pay for an attorney and fight this, much less, on top of it, have to deal with 25% of the wages from their brand new job being seized from them. So the range of harms is unbelievable. People that I've recently spoken to, they can't get jobs because this is now on their either credit rating or it shows up on a background check that they've committed fraud. So even though the state doesn't use MIDAS all by itself anymore, this is continuing to hurt people's lives to this day and will continue to hurt them unless the state steps up and takes some action.
So what is the Supreme Court trying to determine today?
There's a very narrow issue before the Supreme Court, and to put it in layperson's terms, it's when did the clock start ticking for plaintiffs to file their suit? The state says that the clock started ticking when someone got this letter saying that they had been determined to have committed fraud. We say, no, that was just a piece of paper that the vast majority of the people didn't get, by the way. When the clock started ticking, and this is according to the Michigan Constitution, the deprivation of property clause, is when the state seized the money. That was the only time that the plaintiffs could finally go forward and file a lawsuit. Because if they had done that before the money was taken, a court would have tossed them out because their case would have been premature.
The state says that it's already given back something like 98% of the money that it improperly took. You just made the point earlier that that was not the case at all. What are you saying?
I'm saying that all you have to do is trace the audited financial statements. As of their last public proclamation, which was way back in August of 2017, it was demonstrably false. The 2018 audited financial statements won't come out until next spring. But anecdotally, we've talked to thousands of people. Nobody's gotten a full refund. At this point, show me, don't tell me you fixed it.
I've asked the question on this show before, why wouldn't the state make people whole? What do you want for these people who've been wrongfully accused of fraud by the state's automated unemployment insurance system?
At a very minimum, they should be refunded and refunded with interest the entire amount of money that was seized from them. They should be compensated in other ways. For example, people who had to file for bankruptcy, there are going to be attorney's fees. There are going to be filing fees. People who had to hire attorneys to fight criminal charges, there's going to be attorney's fees. So these are all numbers that are capable of being calculated rather easily. They're going to be big numbers, but we just want the people to be made whole.
Jennifer Lord is the lead attorney in a class action lawsuit on behalf of 44,000 people wrongfully accused of fraud and financially hurt by the state because of the unemployment agency's Michigan Integrated Data Automated System, known as MIDAS. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me, Lester.
Coming up, we take you back to the 1920s in Michigan to share a story of an African-American doctor who purchased a home on Detroit's East Side. He did that with some apprehension.
Because of the violence over the summer over on the West Side, when African-Americans had moved into white neighborhoods, he understood this was a huge risk.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Caddy. Well, it's Wednesday. That means it's time to talk Michigan history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
Earlier this year, it was announced that a house at 2905 Garland Street on Detroit's East Side will be preserved. The reason? It was the former home of Dr. Ocean Sweet. And we're going to find out about Ocean Sweet in just a second. But joining us to tell why he's being recognized is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And Kevin Boyle, a professor of history at Northwestern University and the author of Arc of Justice, a saga of race, civil rights, and murder in the Jazz Age. Hi there.
Hi.
So, Rachel, let's start at the beginning. Prior to becoming a part of Detroit's history, who was Dr. Ocean Sweet?
Ocean Sweet was born in Florida. His parents were farmers. They owned a farm in south central Florida, kind of south of Lakeland, Florida. They had a big family. They still struggled, but they did pretty well. And in the early 1900s, the racial violence in Florida started to increase. And so by 1909, Ocean Sweet had witnessed a lynching, and his parents decided that it was time for him to move. He had also started getting older, and his educational opportunities in Florida were starting to wear out. So they sent him north, and he wound up at Wilberforce College in Ohio, later Howard University for his medical credentials, and then by 1921, he's in Detroit.
Kevin, some of the events that Ocean experienced prior to arriving in Detroit helped shape his understanding of the world, especially when he was at university. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. As Rachel said, he grew up
at exactly the time the Southern system of segregation was consolidating, and that was an incredibly violent process. So his little town had a number of lynchings, actually. And then as he moved up to the north, he was on the early edges of what would become the Great Migration, and that racial violence followed him north. For instance, while he was in medical school at Howard in Washington, D.C. in 1919, there was a terrible, vicious race riot in Washington, D.C. in the summer of 1919 that came right up towards Howard University. And then when he moved to Detroit, Detroit was then in the midst of segregating too in slightly different ways than the South had. And that was an incredibly violent process in Detroit. In the summer of 25, which is the summer he bought his house over on Garland Avenue, there were four or five mob violence incidents over on the West Side, in the expanding black community on the West Side, where African Americans were driven out of their homes by white mobs. And he was friends with some of the victims of that violence.
Well, let's talk about Detroit in the mid-20s. What kind of a city was it, Rachel?
It was growing. You're seeing a change in population. You have the migration from the South is beginning. You have immigration from war-torn Europe, or formerly war-torn Europe. So it's beginning to grow, and grow quite quickly. One of the big draws from Detroit were the jobs, and most people think of just the auto industry. But there were so many other industries that were pulling people in. You have steel mills, stockyards, train yards, hotels, restaurants, lumber yards. There were so many industries in Detroit that were starting to boom in the 20s that is just drawing people in from all over.
So, Kevin, you've got this booming city prior to the Great Depression, but not everybody was benefiting in the same way. What kind of inequities were there in a city like Detroit?
Detroit is a severely divided city, and it was divided in all sorts of ways. It was, as Rachel said, it was an immigrant city, and the native-born, really, there was a huge opposition to immigration. There were huge tensions over class, but the most volatile and destructive dividing line was the growing color line. Black population was growing really dramatically, and as that happened, whites in Detroit increasingly started to draw very stark color lines in various parts of city life.
So here comes a physician, Dr. Sweet, moves in, starts a medical practice in Detroit, and was fairly successful.
Absolutely, yeah. If there's one thing about Dr. Sweet, he was an excellent businessman. So when he moved in Detroit in 1921, when he came to Detroit straight out of medical school, he opened his practice in the African-American neighborhood down on the east side in what was called Black Bottom, and he was very successful. He did really well for himself, and like successful Americans throughout the American experience, he decided to move up.
Yep, right. His practice was growing. His family was growing. They needed a bigger home. What kind of obstacles did he face in buying a larger home in Detroit?
That's the heart of the story, in my mind. Until really about 1920, 21, 22, well-to-do African Americans in the city, doctors, lawyers, they generally lived in white neighborhoods. It was completely common. Nobody was really uptight about that. But as that black population increased, then more and more what whites insisted is that African Americans couldn't live in their neighborhoods. It didn't matter whether they were well-to-do, didn't matter if they could afford the house. Their mere presence was going to be objectionable. And so when Dr. Sweet went off to find a house for himself and his wife and their baby, they had a little girl, he ran into the classic, what were becoming the standard obstacles of segregation. Couldn't get white realtors to show him any property in white neighborhoods, though that's where he assumed he was going to live. He couldn't find a place to move in outside of the African-American neighborhoods. The east side African-American neighborhood was very poor. He didn't want to live there. He was a successful man. The west side neighborhood was more middle class, but west side is a long way from the east side, and that's where his work was. And his wife's family was on the east side, too. So he wanted to live on the east side, and he ran into all these obstacles that were put in the way of African-Americans who wanted to move into white neighborhoods.
So he finally does find a house.
He does.
What happened after the Sweet family moved into 2905 Garland Street?
They moved in on September 8th, 1925. Because of the violence over the summer over on the west side, when African Americans had moved into white neighborhoods, he understood this was a huge risk. And so he arranged for the first few nights to have family and friends come with him into the house to defend it. So they had 11 people altogether, Dr. Sweet and Mrs. Sweet, two of Dr. Sweet's brothers, a couple of cousins, and some family friends, 11 people in the house in case there was trouble. First night, there was trouble. September 8th, huge crowd of people, white people, out on the street around the house, but nobody did anything. There wasn't any violence. They just kind of milled around. There were police there to guard the house, but no one inside the house really trusted that the police would do something if push came to shove, if literally push came to shove. Second night, it all happened again. Sometime around 7:30, 8 o'clock that night, just starting to get dark, the crowd comes out, hundreds and hundreds of white people. It's on the corner. It's on the corner of Garland and Charlevoix. It's a corner house, which means the mob can be on two sides. They're out on the street, hundreds and hundreds of white people, police on the sidewalk, African-Americans, 11 people, inside the house. And then one thing happened out on the street, and some members of that white mob out on the street started throwing stones at the house. And when that happened, the African-Americans inside the house, who were armed, they had brought guns with them. I mean, how are you going to defend the house otherwise? Some of them opened fire, and they killed one member of the mob. They hit two, injured one, and they killed another, a white man who was standing across the street from the Sweet's house on the lawn across the street. He had his back turned to the house. He was talking to the people up on the front porch. He wasn't doing anything, but they fired off into the crowd, and they hit him in the back, and they killed him.
So what happened?
Then the police, who had just been kind of standing around, sprung into action. They raced into the house. They arrested all 11 people in the house. So anyone in the house. So they had no idea who fired the shot that killed the man. And within 2 days, they were all charged with first-degree murder, every single one of them, premeditated murder.
That case didn't go that well for the prosecutors.
No, it didn't. The NAACP, then the leading civil rights organization in the country, heard of the case within a couple of days. And they announced that they would mount the defense for the Sweets when they went on trial, and they went on trial in November of 1925 in Detroit. The NAACP would come to the defense. But the NAACP decided right off the bat that they wanted a white lawyer. And the reason was that they knew there was going to be an all-white jury. And the last thing they wanted to do is to have a black lawyer arguing that black people had the right to kill a white guy in Detroit in 1925 so that they could move into a white neighborhood. That's a disaster for a PR move in 1925. So they went in search of a white lawyer. And then they got one.
A pretty famous one, right?
Yeah, it happened to be the greatest criminal defense attorney of his time, arguably in all of American history. His name was Clarence Darrow. And this happened to be, in 1925, the summer of what we now think of as his most famous trial, the famous Scopes Monkey trial. That was the summer of 25. His next trial was in the autumn of 1925 in defense of those 11 African Americans, Dr. Sweet, Mrs. Sweet, and their family and friends.
As you might expect, they didn't get very far in that particular case, resulted in a mistrial. They came back again trying to charge someone in the house of murder, but they decided to not do all 11 at the same time. What happened then?
So what happened in the first trial was Darrow made his classic dramatic defenses, and it ended up with a hung jury. So the prosecutor, figuring, well, if I couldn't win it that way, he would pick one of the defendants, and they picked Dr. Sweet's little brother, Henry. The reason they picked him to try him alone in the second trial was he was the only one who on the night of the murder said, yeah, I fired into the crowd. Everyone else said, I fired into the air. I didn't fire at all. I didn't know what was happening. He said, yeah, there was a mob. I fired into it. So they thought they couldn't convict him. They couldn't convict anyone. So they have another trial in the spring of 1926. Darrow's comes again, and they add a Detroit criminal defense lawyer whose main job had been defending mobsters, and there were a lot of them in Detroit in the 1920s. And this time, they actually get an acquittal. He is actually found not guilty of this crime, which is a dramatic victory for civil rights activism. And I think in that case, that's the reason that I think this story is so important, one of the reasons, and why I think preserving the house on Garland Avenue was so important.
I want to ask you, what about the people in the mob that were throwing stones at the house and breaking windows and such? Did anybody get charged in that?
Not a bit. It's one of the great ironies of the trial, to tell you the truth, that there's an official law in Michigan that says what the size of a mob is, what constitutes a mob. It's 15 armed people joining together. That's a mob. It's 30 unarmed people. And the prosecutor, which this may not have been the best legal strategy, I'm no lawyer, but I don't think this is a good idea, he brought about 80 witnesses out from the street at the trial to say, oh, I was out on the street that night, there was no mob. And so no one got charged on the mob front. They basically, what they did is they said, you know, we're a bunch of neighbors, friendly people standing out on the street. And it's only during the trial that Darrow, in one of his great cross-examinations, gets someone to admit that they were throwing stones at the house.
Rachel, how do these court cases brought against the Sweets still echo in the law today?
Well, one of the things that I find most interesting in the defense strategy was Darrow and the defense team used what was at the time a little-known 1860 Supreme Court ruling in a case called Pond versus the People of Michigan. And in that case, the Supreme Court stated that a man assaulted in his dwelling is not obligated to retreat, but may use such means as are absolutely necessary to repel the assailant from his house or prevent his forcible entry, even to taking a life. And so that ruling is something that we understand today as a stand your ground law. And it was little known. And as I said, it was from the case from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan from 1860 that wound up in the Michigan Supreme Court. And that's what Darrow's team used.
Kevin Boyle, how did Ocean Suite's story go from there?
I think it's one of the great tragedies of the American past. Dr. Sweet won this extraordinary case, but it cost him everything. His wife and child both died within a few years of tuberculosis that to this day, family members will say she contracted while she was in jail. And he moved back into that house. He moved into the house after a few years. He didn't move in immediately, but he moved back into the house. And he lived there until the mid-1950s. One of the great ironies of it in that entire time, he was paying off the house. He didn't have a mortgage on the house. He couldn't get one. Black African-American couldn't get a mortgage to move into a white neighborhood. So essentially, he didn't even have the deed of the house until the 1950s. And then in the late 1950s, his practice went into decline for a whole number of reasons. Part of it physical. He had some physical problems that prevented him from practicing, the transformations in the medical profession. So his life went into decline. He lost the house, essentially, for back taxes. And he then moved back into the African-American inner-city segregated neighborhoods of Black Bottom. He lived above a drugstore at the end of his life. So he ended up back in the very place he sacrificed everything not to be forced to live, to have the freedom to live wherever he wanted. And in the end of his life, that's where he ended up. And the combination of that, I believe, it's always impossible to say for sure, led to the last act, which was in 1960, just as the civil rights movement was sweeping across the South, Dr. Sweet took a handgun and shot himself in the head.
Kevin Boyle is professor of history at Northwestern University and the author of Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age. Thanks for telling Dr. Ocean Sweet's story.
Thank you so much for letting me.
And thanks so much to Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Thanks for your help.
Thank you.
It was announced earlier this year that Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan will receive a $500,000 grant from the National Park Service to expand Dr. Ocean Sweet's historic district, much of it to be focused on the Sweet House at 2905 Garland. One of the proposals on the November ballot would make changes to voting rights and the voting process in Michigan. If passed, Proposal 3 would implement such changes as automatic voter registration, same-day voter registration, and no-excuse absentee voting. These changes are significant, and we want to know what questions you have about Proposal 3. Go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org or call us at 734-764-7840. Simply tell us your name, where you live, and ask your question. We'll try to get as many answers as we can to your questions. That's 734-764-7840. Still to come, Michigan ranks near the bottom when it comes to connecting its veterans to federal VA benefits.
We need to see this as a priority until it improves, until we're, I would say, I mean, I'd like to be number one in the country, but realistically speaking, we need to move up, and it, like, now.
We continue our week-long series looking at Michigan veterans after the break. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You are listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. This year's midterm election is on Tuesday, November 6th. That's now less than a month away. And to understand which issues are most important to Michigan voters, we're dispatching reporters and producers throughout the state to ask people two questions. One, what are the most important issues for you as a Michigan voter? And two, what concerns you most about our political climate right now? We'll keep bringing you their answers as part of our series, Voter Voices. Today, we first hear from voter Jay Davis.
I'm a music instructor at Axis Music Academy in West Bloomfield. There are many, always the issues. The main thing is that people are aware of what the policies are and have some awareness of the people who are running to represent us. So a lot of times that information doesn't get all the way down to grassroots, but interviews and things like this will help get the information out. So that's always important. Nationally, the biggest thing you see is females getting involved in politics and being successful. That's a big deal, because when you have that, there's a possibility that things could turn around. Most Americans aren't so happy. So just like you have the opportunity to be upset, you have the opportunity to do something about it. And the only thing that we really can do is to vote. So it's important that you participate. One vote does count, especially now, and particularly in our community. So hopefully the individuals that are going to represent us will do a good job. We always hope that they do, and we look for the best, hope for the best.
My name is Donna Talbot. I'm a resident of Kalamazoo. I am an academic chair and professor at Western Michigan University. I think that one of the most important issues to me is how we keep devaluing and defunding education, both K through 12 and higher education. And I think that that's something we need to turn around. For me, the most challenging issue is around how uncivil it is. We have gotten to a point where people are applauding how nasty individuals can be rather than looking at issues and how we resolve things without just devolving into unacceptable behavior.
Special thanks to Imani Mixon and Adam Reyes for recording these voter voices. All this week, we're looking at why more veterans are not getting connected to the benefits they might be entitled to. Michigan has consistently ranked in the bottom five states and territories when it comes to helping veterans and their families access federal VA benefits. Today, we hear from Republican State Representative Jason Wentworth, an Army veteran and a former regional coordinator for the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. Representative Wentworth has made veterans' issues a central focus of his time in office. Earlier this year, he worked to get a bill signed into law that that will, for the first time, make state funds available for county governments to help veterans apply for federal VA benefits. Cynthia Candy sat down with Representative Wentworth to talk about the bill and the progress Michigan has made in caring for its veterans.
Overall, how do you think the state of Michigan is doing in terms of adequately providing for its veterans?
You know, currently I think we are doing well. We have lots of room for improvement. But coming from where we were, you know, 4 or 5 years ago to where we're at today, we've made some good progress and good strides.
Such as?
You know, I think one of the things you mentioned was me being a regional coordinator. I think that program, which was started, you know, when the NVAA kind of took off, is a good program. I think the VCAT, the Veteran Community Action Team model that we're doing in statewide is a good model as well. I think just the creation of the agency was a good start. And then our accreditation of our veteran service officers definitely has helped improve the quality of benefits that our veterans are receiving.
These veterans service officers, these accredited officers, exactly what do they do and why are they important?
So they help veterans file benefits through the federal VA. And it could be from, you know, aid and attendance, pension, it could be disability. And they help with all other types of aspects around benefits as well. They could provide information to family members on death benefits, burial benefits, things like that. So it's very important because the federal system is full of red tape and barriers. It can be stressful. It can be overwhelming. And veterans will turn away and just say, you know, forget it. I was denied, or I didn't have the proper paperwork, or I just can't, quite frankly, you know, navigate the system. Yeah. So I give up. And that's what I saw happening over and over again when I met with these veterans in our communities. They would say, well, I tried that and it didn't work. So I gave up and I don't have time for that. And our veterans in the state are, you know, a major portion of them are 65 or older. And so they're aging to the point where these gentlemen and women have never asked for a benefit in their life. They've came back, they went to work, they put their head down, they raised their family, and now they're aging, their health may be failing, their income might have been reduced due to retirement or other, you know, means. And so They're reaching out and they're saying, you know what, I do have an issue or this has been bothering me and I do need help with this. And so we need to be there as a state for these veterans that have, you know, given so much.
And these accredited veteran services officers, it just seems they're the linchpin. All of this really depends on a vet being able to find that navigator to help them figure this all out.
It really is. And that's the whole clutch of our system in Michigan is making sure that when that veteran does need help, that they know where to go.
Now, you said to us it has gotten better. Things have gotten better with having veteran services officers. Do we now have enough of these officers working in enough parts of the state?
No, we don't have enough veteran service officers in our state, both from a veteran service organization through the contract, which is a service coalition contract. We don't have enough there, and also we don't have enough in our counties, at the county offices. So majority of our counties have veteran service officers accredited that serve in the county building, but there are several that don't, and so that's what causes the problem. And then these veteran service officers that are, you know, available within those counties are sometimes only available for, let's say, the first and fourth. I'm just pulling a number out here. You know,
sure.
First and third Monday of every month, from noon to four, you know, in the basement of the library.
So what do you think could make things easier for veterans to number one, find, and then number two, contact and work with these veteran services officers?
Yeah, I think the main thing for me and what I've seen across the state is the counties across the state who have veteran service officers located in the county building are doing a lot of the claim work in the state. So a lot of the benefits are being filed and initiated at the county level. That's because common sense tells us that when a veteran needs help with government, they go to their county building where their seat is. And if there's a county veteran service officer there, that service officer helps them with that paperwork. Problem is that those county buildings, in most cases, those veteran service departments have been stagnant in funding for decades because, you know, local governments have been, you know, reduced levels of funding year after year. And so they're trying to hang on to their veteran services. They're not focused on growing their veteran services in their county. even though most of the veterans in their county are now aging to where they do need the additional people in the departments, they can't fund them. So, you know, put yourself in a county commissioner's shoes and a veteran service director comes to you and says, we need more people. And they say, well, you've been at this level of funding for 5, 10, 15 years. If we increase your funding this year, we can't reduce it next, right? That would be a political nightmare. So they maintain the level of funding and never grow their departments in a lot of these counties. And it's unfortunate because we're at a point in our state where we need to invest in these services. So my issue is, as a state government, we have to say, look, we need to increase the level of service we provide at the county level to our veterans and their families. And if that means providing them the funding that they need in order to grow their services, and that's what we have to do. And so we passed our House bill, which would allow that and was signed by the governor. So now we're going to, you know, invest in county services for the first time in our state's history to help grow the county departments. And counties will tell you now that it's great that the state's putting that out there. Mm-hmm. So it's sustainable now. They can grow their department. They can invest in the services. And we're making it so that they can hire an additional person, a part-time person. They can, you know, increase the level of current service. And also, you know, if they need a secretary or they need, you know, additional space, whatever it may be, but to allow them to have that opportunity to grow the department.
Representative, looking at the new strategic plan that was put out by the MVAA for the next 4 years, there's very little mention about the need for these veterans services officers. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't looked at the strategic plan in depth just yet. But, you know, I think I guess when you look at the veteran services or the veteran issues across the state, there are many issues that you can delve into and improve. Veteran services and the delivery is just one of them, one of many. So I would have to look exactly at the plan to see if any of the strategic plan actually addresses some issues that might relate to the veteran service delivery. So there may be some other aspects of that plan that kind of touch on this, but not directly.
Would you like to see that as a priority?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to see this as a priority until it improves, until we're, I would say, I mean, I'd like to be number one in the country, but realistically speaking, we need to move up and it, like, now. So yeah, I would like to see that as a priority. I think the MVA has taken steps to help improve that. I think, you know, the bill that we just did will improve that, but the bill that I had originally to where I ended, you know, until we had the bill passed is different. So mm-hmm. I'm going to continue to push, and improve that bill and improve the amount of resources we allocate towards this bill, because I think it's that important. I think it's one of the issues that, again, I hear continually on the ground.
I want to discuss the state's ability to find veterans. A performance audit of the MVA by the State Auditor General came out in February of this year. It was pretty critical. The first finding said the MVA had not implemented the processes required to identify and contact veterans who are already receiving state aid to see if they are eligible for more benefits. And veterans advocates we've spoken to say they don't know where veterans in their communities live. Why is it hard for the MVAA to find veterans and contact them?
That's a good question. I think there are many ways that we can track veterans that are getting out of the service. And we have mechanisms in the state where we can compile information. It's the state government to state government or state agency to state agency sharing information that I think is the main issue. So, for example, we can use the Secretary of State veteran designation on their driver's license. That list exists where a veteran comes in, they show their DD-214, they get the designation put on their license. The Secretary of State has that list. You know, I believe that list should be shared amongst agencies so we can, you know, reach out to those veterans and say, look, you know, the MVAA exists. This is what they do. If you need help, here's the contact information. And then also, you know, let's say a DHHS, you know, agency where a veteran comes in and is seeking, you know, assistance or their family, you know, have you served or a member of your family ever served in the United States Armed Forces? That question is asked. If the answer to that is yes, that information should be shared. at minimal to the NBAA in order so that they can compile a list that we can then use to communicate to veterans and their families across our state so that they are aware of the benefits that exist and we can continually track their movement throughout the state when it comes to the benefits. So once they reach out to an agency, it's important that we don't lose that veteran. A lot of veterans will say they don't self-identify as a veteran because they're afraid that they're going to lose the benefit that they're trying to apply for. And that's just not the case in most situations. In most situations, they're eligible for additional benefits. We need to get that information out there to veteran population in the state of Michigan.
And those two steps you spelled out, Representative, seem very, very clear and very common sense. So why haven't they happened?
Yeah, again, I don't know the answer to that as far as, you know, interagency policy goes. But I do know that it can happen. Other agencies across the state do it. They share information. They have a memorandum of understanding where they share information amongst the agencies. You know, we're serving veterans. These aren't, and I'll say this, you know, with all due respect, these aren't customers or, you know, clients. These are veterans that served our country. And as state citizens, we owe them the right to, you know, understand and know what the benefits exist for our state for them. And so I think that agencies look at veterans as these are my customers or these are my clients, when in all reality, we're serving them as a state. So to me, it's important that we do share it.
I want to move over to veterans' homes. It certainly seems like the MVAA has been very focused on them since the deplorable conditions at that Grand Rapids homes were uncovered in 2016. This August, the MVAA announced it's opening a new home in Macomb County and rebuilding the Grand Rapids home. And each home is expected to house 128 veterans. So while that's great for these 260 or so veterans, what about the tens of thousands of other vets who don't have access to these homes and don't have access to someone to help them get benefits? Can the MVAA meet their needs as well?
You know, I think that's a good question as well. So I think there's two answers to that question. One being, you know, the goal of our state, in my opinion, should be these veterans are generally independent. They like to take care of themselves. You know, I can say it because I'm a veteran. We're stubborn. And, you know, we want to take care of ourselves and we want to stay in our home as long as possible. I think as a state, we need to recognize that and ensure that we can have a service available to veterans that keep them in their homes as long as possible. And so I think that's something we can improve on in the state. And so that the need for veteran homes, you know, in the future might not be as big as what we're anticipating if we try to use the model of keeping veterans in their home. So I think that's one answer. The next answer is, you know, I think this is just phase one. I wasn't a part of the legislature when they passed the bills and such and the appropriations for the veteran homes being built. But I think it's necessary when you look at other states and how they have the facilities for, you know, veterans, mm-hmm. Nursing care facilities. Mm-hmm. So it's just a strategy that, you know, I'm not a part of that conversation within the agency. And I wasn't a part of that conversation in the legislature. So I look at it as let's focus on keeping these veterans in their home as long as possible. And let's make sure that that's a strong focus as well as, you know, improving our home facilities and current facilities and future facilities, making sure that it's not just a small number of veterans, but we're serving a large number.
And keeping people in their home seems to circle right back to having enough veteran services officers spread evenly throughout the state so people can find them.
Right, exactly.
Jason Wentworth is an Army veteran and the Republican state representative serving the 97th District in mid-Michigan. Representative, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Continuing our series on tomorrow's show, we'll talk with an Air Force veteran and former director of a statewide nonprofit that serves Michigan vets.
I think every veteran here in the state of Michigan is very lucky to have people like Representative Wentworth looking out for us. On the other hand, I don't think that an individual should have to go through the extraordinary effort of getting themselves elected to the state legislature to take care of a problem when an agency was founded to take care of a problem 5 years ago.
Assessing the performance of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. That's tomorrow on Stateside. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.